play dumb. Goodbye to the crown.
Farewell, the jewel crown. Farewell, the velvet gown. Watch it all come tumbling down. Goodbye to the crown. Goodbye to the crown.
To the crown. Goodbye to the royal we and all its famous pedigree.
Let's put this dog to sleep.
Goodbye to the crown.
Farewell the jewel crown. Farewell the velvet gown. Watch it all come tumbling down. Goodbye to the crown. Farewell the jewel crown. Farewell the velvet gown. Watch it all come tumbling down. Goodbye to the crown. Farewell the jewel crown. Farewell the velvet gown. Watch it all come tumbling down.
And welcome to Here We Stand. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. This is the voice of the Republic and the Resistance. Farewell to the crown on today, September 11th. It's not just a Twin Tower that fell. It's their whole bloody system that's coming down, folks. And today we're going to go into showing how that triple-headed beast, that monarchy of church, state, and big money, is on the verge of collapse. And I don't mean that necessarily in an immediate literal sense, but history is working against it, undermining it at every moment. We're going to be having very important updates today about something very important happening in New York City. And I don't mean the traditional gathering at the big hole, what used to be a hole, where the towers came down, but rather something further up Manhattan, outside the United Nations. There's 13 indigenous elders gathered there right now, and they've been hassled by the police. They're not moving. They are there to demand the expulsion of the Vatican from the United Nations. Their proclamation can be found at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. I really urge you to go there and look at what they have to say. They are not simply calling for the expulsion. They are beginning a long process of really their form of exorcism, of fasting, of prayer, of sending out a spiritual energy around the planet, saying the time for these murderous genocidal powers is long gone. And it was interesting, with the news, of course, of Lizzie Britt dying and Charlie the Idiot taking her place. All of that is part of this. We're going to get into the close connection between the so-called British crown and the crown in Rome, the secular and religious monarchs. But the third aspect of the monarchy, our big enemy, of course, is the corporatocracy. And it's interesting how that evil trinity keeps raising its heads. It was responsible for the mass murder of indigenous people all over the world and here in Canada. That trinity of money funding the church and the government giving it a legitimacy to go in and wipe out, in Canada alone, 66,000 indigenous children over a century. Well, what's really interesting, I can't resist telling you this, folks, right away. One of the things, the reasons that Queen Elizabeth died conveniently when she did, and Chuck stepped into the breach, was that one of the things that has happened at the UN, let me just give you a bit of a background here. If you go to murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates, look at the last four or five postings. That's the whole history, beginning in July 29th, when Bergoglio, Pope Francis, admits to genocide. Indigenous nations then start issuing banishment and reclamation orders all over their territories, where people have the legal obligation and right to go in and seize Catholic Church properties, to arrest their officers, to seize all of the wealth, and as reparations for these admitted crimes of genocide. In response to that as well, it was a move at the UN, and it began among indigenous delegates from various NGOs, but then it picked up support. Nicaragua was the first country to support them. And it's interesting, this last year, Nicaragua has expelled their papal nuncio. That's the Vatican so-called ambassador to their country, because this guy was funding the political opposition movements to try to bring down the Nicaraguan government. So they gave him the boot. So naturally, these folks are very open to and very encouraging of any move to expel the Vatican from the UN, because it's their obvious enemy, just like it is of any sovereign people all over the world. Now, another strong supporter of what we're doing are the Lenape people, and they have the land where the UN sits. The traditional Lenape people in that part of Manhattan, originally the Manahare native people, they have also backed the elders. There will be events happening very much off the radar. Now, if you go to New York now, if you're in there and you go by the UN, they may or may not be there, because our latest thing, I talked to them about 90 minutes ago, and they had been receiving a lot of harassment from the police. They may reconvene to an area near there. I don't want to say yet where, because they're under harassment now and we're concerned about their safety. But they do have support. There's alternative media that are monitoring this. So there's our own network that's got it, you know, monitored and rallying support. And this is something that the corporatocracy did not want. And let me go into a little bit of a detail and background, because today we're going to explore not only the nature of this three-headed beast, but how we can resist it personally, spiritually, and politically, and things we're doing on the ground right now, including through our New Republic Alliance. This is now a network of people in 12 countries now that are building common law republics. They're opting out of the corporate system. They're reclaiming sovereignty on the ground with their own assemblies and courts, like we initiated in Kanata in 2015 with the Republic of Kanata. And by the way, republicofkanata.org is the website, murderbydecree.com. Look under ITCCS updates to follow everything I'm talking about today. Well, here's another interesting thing that happened at the UN. We got a notification of one of the indigenous groups that they have had interest from one of the UN commissions of the hard evidence that we have of what went on in the Kamloops residential school death camp. Now, don't forget, and this is related to why Elizabeth died so quickly and Charlie stepped in. It's kind of a repeat of the way Ratzinger was taken out so quickly by our court action in 2013, and then Bergoglio was put in as the spin doctor to put the new face on the Vatican. Well, that's exactly what Charles is doing now. He just made a statement to the press that he's going to shake up the monarchy. He's going to make it more a monarchy of the people. So, for example, he's talking about moving out of Buckingham Palace and going to a more humble palatial estate where he can spend that £89 million he gets free, tax-free every year from British taxpayers. And, you know, part of the spin doctrine image that things are going to be different now. Well, here's the reality of what happened. Queen Elizabeth, as you know, here's the story, in case any of you new listeners don't know the story. William Coombs, one of my friends, was held as a child at the Kamloops death camp and the Mission death camps that they still call residential schools, where over half the children never came back. And October 10th, 1964, he was 12 years old, he saw Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip show up that day. Now, we checked with the records of the so-called royal visits, and yes, they were in Canada at that time. That's on the record. And October 10th, 1964, he remembers the kids were all taken out to a picnic at a place, believe it or not, called Dead Man's Creek. It's west of Kamloops. And he says he remembers, and I remember William telling me this on my radio show, Vancouver Co-op Radio, while I still had it. And he said that they all had to kneel down and kiss the Queen's white boot. And then they all had a picnic. They gave them lemonade, and William passed out from the lemonade. But before that happened, he saw Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip take 10 children away. Now, those 10 children were never seen again, 7 boys and 3 girls. Now, look at the date and look at the numbers. 10 of October 1964, 10th month, 10th day, 6-4, adds up to 10. There were 10 children. 82 days before the end of the year, 8 plus 2 is 10. 10 members of the royal family at that time. Now, Queen Elizabeth was the oldest monarch, the longest serving monarch in British history, 70 years, 7-0, 7 years longer than Queen Victoria. 7 and 10, there are the two numbers adding up to 70. Read in the book of Revelation, there's a beast ridden on by the Antichrist, and on this beast there's 7 heads and 10 horns. The 7 heads refer to, just go to Revelation 17, verse 9, and it describes this beast. it describes the seven hills, which are, of course, the seven hills of Rome, and 10 kingdoms. Now, that number 10 is significant in satanic numerology because it means it's the end of a cycle and the beginning of a new cycle. And in the book of Revelation, they talk about Antichrist, or the beast of Rome, if you like, on the seven hills, bringing 10 kingdoms into existence that will take over the world on behalf of Satan. Now, when you add all of that up, that incident that occurred in at Dead Man's Creek, where the 10 children vanished and never seen again, it indicates satanic ritual. And we should not be surprised that Elizabeth Windsor reigned so long. I don't like to use that word. She didn't reign over anything, because as we're going to describe today, the monarchy is a fiction. It hasn't existed lawfully since 1649, when it was deposed by Parliament. But whether or not you believe in that, these people believe in it. We brought a police accredited psychic into the area, and she saw the bodies of those children in the ground very near there. She said they were killed that same day and sacrificed ritually, and their bodies arranged ritually. Well, when we took this evidence to the International Common Law Court of Justice, and they subpoenaed Elizabeth Windsor and all the other people involved, and they didn't get a response, we experienced through that what the Cromwellian Parliament did in 1649, when they put King Charles I, like King Charles III, on trial. And he refused to plead, and as a result, they lawfully found him guilty and chopped his head off for having waged a war of aggression against the people in Parliament. Well, by not pleading, you're admitting to guilt. And that's what happened in the International Common Law verdict that found Elizabeth Windsor and others guilty. By not contesting what's being said about them, they agreed. It was tacit admission of guilt. She did not contest that we said you were responsible for the death of those children. And as head officer of the Church of England and Canada, responsible generally for the genocide in Canada. Now, add to that the fact that that evidence is now before a UN committee. Now, if you're the British monarchy, the last thing you want to do is keep alive the chief witness to that crime. So conveniently, Elizabeth dies before September 11th, Charles steps in. But it gets even more heinous because if you may recall, I remember very well because I was in London, England at the time. It was September 2010, Pope Benedict, before we forced him out of office, went to meet Queen Elizabeth. They went up to Holyrood Castle in Edinburgh for a private confab, as they say, and they signed what was called the Holyrood Agreement, and that created the terms by which the Church of England would go back into the Church of Rome. They effectively fused as of that date. Now, she violated her coronation oath. She should have been deposed immediately, but of course, this was all kept under the covers, didn't come out until our trial in 2013, that brought out all this evidence from insiders, documents, the whole gamut. Now, at that point, the Church of England was linked to the Church of Rome. It had to follow its policy of crimen solicitanus, where you cover up crimes against children. It was linked to all of those crimes because, of course, church and state did the crime together over many years. The genocide in Canada was just one example. London and Rome have been tag team in this genocide for many centuries. But of course, as the chief living witness to that, you can't have Elizabeth Windsor hanging around. So we very much believe that something was put in her drink or something happened to her while she was asleep to conveniently remove her, and now Charles is in. Now, Charles is doing what Bergoglio did when he came into the popeship. And what you've got to do is you put window dressing on to improve the image of the institution. You distract from the crime. You hide its assets. That's very important because, of course, as you know, Bergoglio, Pope Francis, is calling in all the assets of the Catholic Church ever since the revelation came out in Canada where he admitted to genocide. At that point, he can be lawfully sued. Now, the $780 billion deal he had signed with China on July 23rd in Prince Rupert immediately set off alarm bells in Beijing. They're saying, well, look, if you guys are going to get sued, where's our money? So Bergoglio, as you can follow in the news, has called in all money into the Vatican Bank. He's decapitated the heads of the Knights of Malta to grab their money. He's following what his paymasters in Beijing are doing. And they are doing a mutual back-rubbing operation. And similarly in England now, under the smokescreen of reforms, Charles is, we predict, funneling the money of the Bank of England directly towards China. This is the direction in world geopolitics now. Everything is flooding to Beijing. The Road and Belt Initiative, it's called, that's channeling all of the roads, tunnels, railway networks, airlines, everything towards Central Asia so the resources can go in that direction. 80% of the world's economic growth is happening under the Chinese control now in the Indo-Pacific region. So all of the money is heading east to Beijing. And now Charles, like Pope Francis, is going to ensure that. That's the general overview of what we understand is going on. Now, I know that's a lot to digest, but we're going to feed this to you in pieces as well. Within the Republic Alliance, we're starting an educational campaign to bring everybody up to speed about this knowledge of genocide, the nature of this three-headed beast, what we can do about it, how we have done something about it, enforcing Ratzinger out of office, establishing the Republic of Kanada, and now other republics in Holland, in France, in Spain, Italy, Greece, Australia, New Zealand, Denmark, America. These countries are all part of the Republic Alliance now, plus three indigenous nations, including the Chilcotin Indigenous Nation, that signed a treaty with our republic 2 months ago. This means we're setting up a parallel system of governance, of spirituality, of personal sovereignty. It isn't just you saying, oh, I'm declaring independence from the system, I'm not using my capitalized letters anymore. That doesn't do anything because you're still within the jurisdiction, de facto, of the old system. You need to create your own collective jurisdiction. That's what the sovereign republics are. You can read it all, republicofcanada.org. But what that means is that we have to consolidate not only our numbers and our perspective, unite our numbers, but consolidate our understanding. And that's what we're going to be doing in these educational series. If you want to be part of that, write to Republic National Council at protonmail.com. You can either connect with a republic in your country or help form one. And you can be part of these online educationals we're going to be doing. That's very important because you can't take action unless you understand the nature of what you're up against, the nature of the enemy, and the nature of yourself. Now, in that regard, for the next 15 minutes, before we take a little break with our good buddy George Carlin to add some levity, and I've got to say it is kind of funny seeing Charlie sitting there on the throne because the guy is a substandard moron. I had a direct experience of that, actually a little anecdote from yours truly, Kevin Annett. In 1981, I worked at the Museum of Anthropology in Vancouver, and lo and behold, who showed up but Charlie and his dad, Prince Philip. They were there to unveil a carving by the Haida carver. What the hell was that guy's name anyway? Anyway, I don't remember. He was some Haida carver, some puppet Indian guy. And they were there to unveil the carving. Now, Charles is standing there with a Hollywood Indian headdress on to the guffaws and muffled laughter of everybody who was there. And he actually says, it's appropriate that I'm opening this this exhibit because I'm an Indian chief too, you know. Well, nobody really knew what the hell Charlie was talking about. I don't know if he did either. But that's the level of IQ we're dealing with here. Now, what better guy to have in the chief executive position than a dummy who can be manipulated? And that's, of course, going to help us because while there's something kind of sympathetic about a mummy image sitting on the throne, there isn't about a moron who's, how old is he now, 74? He's not going to last long. He's probably going to go through what his predecessor, Charles I, went through, hopefully, when our republic rises up in England as well. And by the way, there's a support of 58% of Canadians for a republic in Canada and a support of 48% of Brits for a republic. Now, that's not what you see on the internet, all these British people waving Union Jacks. Nope, a lot of people on the ground are disenchanted, and they got to link up with a Republic Alliance and form their own sovereign republics where they are. That's our agenda, folks. Now, more on that, though, before the break. I want you to look at a few things that are good weapons to use. And it wasn't just in the Book of Revelation where they're describing the, you know, the seven hills of Rome, the ten-headed beast connected to these satanic rituals. But when the Republic was established in England in 1649, they passed a law in Parliament saying monarchy is forever abolished in England. Anyone who tries to reestablish it is committing treason and can and should be prosecuted. And that law is still in the books. Charles II overthrew Parliament in a military coup in 1660, but that didn't give him lawful legitimacy. It just meant he was a de facto power, not a de jure one. That means since 1649, there has been no legitimate lawful monarch in England, and there still isn't. It's a fictitious monarchy. And I had proof of that. It was interesting. When we started our campaign about the Rez schools, I wrote to the Privy Council in London, which is officially supposed to be the head governing office with the Governor General. They're the main body that runs Canada, if it was a monarchical system. Well, I got back in writing letters saying, the Privy Council has no authority in Canada. Well, that didn't make sense, because everything we're told officially is that it does. But, of course, it's like the Vatican. It pretends to be a government and a state. It's a Santa Claus state, just like the British monarchy is. They don't actually exist. It's like a corporation. It's a big fiction that has everybody fooled. So the rule of one person over many, that's what monarchy means. Mono, archos, one ruler. Well, folks, we all know from the law of nature there is no one ruler except God, the creator, the source of all life and truth. That's, if there is a governance, that's it. You can't have a human ruler. You can't have one person, because monarchy is an affront to God. And it says that all through scripture. It says that in a lot of sources. And in one of the places it says that, I urge you to pull out your Bibles and go to 1 Samuel 8. In that, the prophet Samuel is saying to the people of Israel, you're not to have a king, because at that point it was ruled by judges. And the people kept saying, no, no, we want to be like other nations. We want to have a king. And Samuel, on behalf of God, said, well, this is what your king will do. He will take your sons and put them in his armies. He will seize your crops. He will seize your daughters. He will seize your fields. Take one-tenth of all that you grow. Make you work for him and die for him. That's what you'll have if you have a king. But the people cried out and said, no, we have chosen our king. We demand one. And so God says to Samuel, fine, let them have one. Let them learn from that what happens. Now, here's the problem. Have we learned? History keeps going back all the time. We had a revolution in England in 1649 that led directly to the American Revolution, because after Charles overthrew it and wiped out as many Republicans as he could find and reestablished a false criminal monarchy, a lot of those refugees went to the Plymouth colonies and the Puritan colonies in England, and they brought that seed of liberation over to America. And the first Plymouth Covenant in 1628, and again affirmed under the Republic in England in 1658, it said, the people are sovereign under God. We have no king, we have no rulers, no pope, no king over us, only the people. That idea led to the American Republic. The first time in history, the people were all sovereign together. Now, they continually tried to destroy that and turn back the clock. You're seeing another example, the very existence of the papacy in Rome. The so-called religious monarch, the king and queens of England, the political monarchs, and this corporate monarch now, the corporatocracy, they all rule from the same idea. They're above the law, and they're not accountable to anybody. Well, who's more above the law than the corporatocracy, the big pharma that says, you will now get shots in your arm? It's the same principle, and that principle has to have its head cut off. We have to uproot it in our hearts, in our minds, in our churches, in the governments, in the corporatocracy. That's the whole meaning of sovereign independence. And so it's right there in scripture. It's right there in our traditions. They can try to wipe it out all the time. And we know a lot of examples from America of how that's, they're trying to do that continually. And I mean by that both parties. I don't exempt anybody from that, because China is rapidly funding both Republicans and Democrats to tear the country apart. They know Sun Tzu very well. They know you have to get your enemies fighting each other. That's how you pick up the pieces. Why Americans aren't uniting against the new superpower that's buying up and destroying their whole country is beyond me. But it's that fog that exists because we watch the internet too much. We've got to go back to the law of nature and our own hearts, our own recovered history. There's been no lawful monarchy since 1649. There's never been a lawful monarchy in Rome, anywhere really. And no one is above the law. That's basic to common law. Immunity from the law is never bestowed by your position or your status. That's basic to common law. Just because you're sitting on a throne in Rome or London doesn't mean you're above the law. That's why Ratzinger resigned. He knew he'd be arrested under the law of nature if he steps outside the Vatican after we prosecuted him. Charles knows that too, and that's why I believe his days are numbered. Just watch over the next few weeks and months. He'll be making lots of noises about reforming and being more democratic, and that's to distract as their whole thing comes down and as they fog the fact that they're sending all the money east to Beijing. That's kind of the overview, folks. We're going to have more after the break. There's a lot more to say, but I'm going to let your minds rest and listen to George Carlin, because he's talking here. It's a funny bit he did, the stand-up comedian George Carlin. He did a bit before he died called Saving the Planet. And in there, he not only mocks human pretension, but he talks about the great law of balance, the law of nature. This is what he's really talking about. Trust nature. It's the source of all goodness, and it's within each one of us. That kingdom is within each human heart. That's where royalty lies, not in another person, not in an institution. The purity within each of us, that's what he's talking about, I believe. So have a listen, and after George Carlin, we'll be back.
You got people like this around you. Country's full of them now. People walking around all day long, every minute of the day, worried about everything. Worried about the air, worried about the water, worried about the soil. Worried about insecticides, pesticides, food additives, carcinogens. Worried about radon gas, worried about asbestos. Worried about saving endangered species. Let me tell you about endangered species, all right? Saving endangered species is just one more arrogant attempt by humans to control nature. It's arrogant meddling. It's what got us in trouble in the first place. Doesn't anybody understand that? Interfering with nature. Over 90% of all the species that have ever lived on this planet, ever lived, are gone. Whoosh. They're extinct. We didn't kill them all. They just disappeared. That's what nature does. They disappear these days at the rate of 25 a day. And I mean regardless of our behavior. Irrespective of how we act on this planet, 25 species that were here today will be gone tomorrow. Let them go gracefully. Leave nature alone. Haven't we done enough? We're so self-important. So self-important. Everybody's going to save something now. Save the trees. Save the bees. Save the whales. Save those snails. And the greatest arrogance of all, save the planet. What? Are these fucking people kidding me? Save the planet? We don't even know how to take care of ourselves yet. We haven't learned how to care for one another. We're going to save the fucking planet? I'm getting tired of that shit. I'm tired of fucking Earth Day. I'm tired of these self-righteous environmentalists, these white bourgeois liberals who think the only thing wrong with this country is there aren't enough bicycle paths. People trying to make the world safe for their Volvos. Besides, environmentalists don't give a shit about the planet. They don't care about the planet. Not in the abstract, they don't. You know what they're interested in? A clean place to live. Their own habitat. They're worried that someday in the future they might be personally inconvenienced. Narrow, unenlightened self-interest doesn't impress me. Besides, there is nothing wrong with the planet. Nothing wrong with the planet. The planet is fine. The people are fucked. Difference. The planet is fine. Compared to the people, the planet is doing great. It's been here 4.5 billion years. Did you ever think about the arithmetic? Planet has been here 4.5 billion years. We've been here, what, 100,000? Maybe 200,000? And we've only been engaged in heavy industry for a little over 200 years. 200 years versus 4.5 billion. And we have the conceit to think that somehow we're a threat? That somehow we're going to put in jeopardy this beautiful little blue-green ball that's just a-floating around the sun? The planet has been through a lot worse than us. Been through all kinds of things worse than us. Been through earthquakes, volcanoes, plate tectonics, continental drift, solar flares, sunspots, magnetic storms, the magnetic reversal of the poles, hundreds of thousands of years of bombardment by comets and asteroids and meteors, worldwide floods, tidal waves, worldwide fires, erosion, cosmic rays, recurring ice ages, and we think some plastic bags and some aluminum cans are going to make a difference? The planet isn't going anywhere. We are. We're going away. Pack your shit, folks. We're going away. And we won't leave much of a trace either. Thank God for that. Maybe a little styrofoam. Planet will be here, we'll be long gone. Just another failed mutation. Just another closed-end biological mistake. An evolutionary cul-de-sac. The planet will shake us off like a bad case of fleas. A surface nuisance. You want to know how the planet's doing? Ask those people at Pompeii who are frozen into position from volcanic ash. How the planet's doing. Want to know if the planet's all right? Ask those people in Mexico City or Armenia or 100 other places buried under thousands of tons of earthquake rubble if they feel like a threat to the planet this week. How about those people in Kilauea, Hawaii, who build their homes right next to an active volcano and then wonder why they have lava in the living room? The planet will be here for a long, long, long time after we're gone, and it will heal itself, it will cleanse itself, because that's what it does. It's a self-correcting system. The air and the water will recover, the earth will be renewed, and if it's true that plastic is not degradable, well, the planet will simply incorporate plastic into a new paradigm, the earth plus plastic. The earth doesn't share our prejudice towards plastic. Plastic came out of the Earth. The Earth probably sees plastic as just another one of its children. Could be the only reason the Earth allowed us to be spawned from it in the first place. It wanted plastic for itself. Didn't know how to make it. Needed us. Could be the answer to our age-old philosophical question, why are we here?
Plastic. Assholes.
So... the plastic is here. Our job is done. We can be phased out now. And I think that's really started already, don't you? I mean, to be fair, the planet probably sees us as a mild threat, something to be dealt with. And I'm sure the planet will defend itself in the manner of a large organism, like a beehive or an ant colony can muster a defense. I'm sure the planet will think of something. What would you do if you were the planet trying to defend against this pesky, troublesome species? Let's see. Viruses. Viruses might be good. They seem vulnerable to viruses. And viruses are tricky, always mutating and forming new strains whenever a vaccine is developed. Perhaps this first virus could be one that compromises the immune system of these creatures. Perhaps a human immunodeficiency virus, making them vulnerable to all sorts of other diseases and infections that might come along. And maybe it could be spread sexually, making them a little reluctant to engage in the act of reproduction. Well, that's a poetic note. And it's a start. And I can dream, can't I? See, I don't worry about the little things. Bees, trees, whales, snails. I think we're part of a greater wisdom than we will ever understand. A higher order. Call it what you want. Know what I call it? The big electron. The big electron. Whoa. 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 It doesn't punish. It doesn't judge at all. It just is. And so are we. For a little while. Thanks for being here with me for a little while tonight. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, New York City. Take care of yourself. Take care of yourself. And take care of somebody else. Thank you. Good night.
Well, in other words, folks, humility and perspective. I like that he ended on take care of yourself and take care of somebody else. Well, that's, you know, what we've got to do. And I wanted to say, you know, after the opening, I get very involved, excited by a lot of the stuff I'm learning all the time. And what we can never lose sight of is we're talking about reality, people, children. You know, when we watched that whole farce of Lizzie dying and Charlie stepping into her place, you know, I didn't think of, good, the lizard's dead now, which is emails have been sent to me saying that. Oh, good, we're free of the Satanism now. The lizard's dead, as if she was the only one, right? But no, I didn't think of that at all. I didn't think of, you know, the political response we need to do. I didn't think the Republic. I thought of 10 children in the ground, slaughtered and put in the ground, their throats cut. I thought of William Coombs dying in St. Paul's Hospital of lethal injection, arsenic poisoning, according to his nurse, Chloe Kirker. I've got her on film describing it. I had all the symptoms of arsenic poisoning, held in there until he died from it, after he was about to go public with what he witnessed of Elizabeth Windsor and Philip taking those kids and never to be seen again. Murdered. He was an Indian. Of course, he can do that in Canada, because under the Indian Act, they're not citizens. They're wards of the state, like a child. And a ward can be killed by their parent, legally. So I think of them. I think of William. I think of those kids. I think of all the kids going to die tomorrow. And when you've seen up close the effect of this, when you've had your own life destroyed by it, as I have, you realize this thing we're facing is more monstrous than any one individual or any one system. It's some kind of collective evil going on. And I don't exclude any of us from that, because we're all born into it. We're raised with it. We think with its mind. Even, you know, it's funny, somebody wrote me the other day and said, I've been awake my whole life. And I couldn't resist. I wrote back and I said, well, you might be awake, but give me the proof that you're not still in bed with the beast. You might be lying there awake, but you're still in bed with the beast, aren't you? We're all born into it. We're all part of it. And we need that kind of humility George Carlin was talking about, to realize that ultimately this doesn't really matter that much, especially since we're in a state of mass psychosis. And, you know, the simple proof of that is just leave the city for a while, folks. Turn off your internet if possible. Turn off all your devices and go on, just go off on a mountain and be alone for a while. You'll see the truth then. And then you'll look at what you were thinking a day or two before or doing, thinking, what the hell was I doing? We are in a state of confusion inherently. You know, the very fact that you're using the internet to listen to this, you're not going to get clarity. You're going to get some more information. You might be inspired by a few things I say. It's like I used to say from the pulpit in Port Alberni. You know, don't listen to me. Look inside for the answer. Maybe I'll inspire you a bit, but, you know, don't put anybody on a pedestal. Don't look anyone as a source of information. And we all do it. We all point to the latest expert on something so we don't have to think, so we don't have to risk, so we don't have to act. You know, the only reason I'm not in a cozy sinecure now in some college, you know, is that I was blocked from retraining after I got thrown out by the church. The hidden hand of nature kept saying, nope, not supposed to do that, Kev. Nope, you're not supposed to retrain and get comfy again somewhere in a mindless career. No, with a pension and salary and all that, it'll just blind you even more. You're supposed to be out on this cold road of suffering, because that's how you get your mind back. And you can't will that. None of us want that. We don't go out and say, hey, I'm going to be liberated now. I'm going to be awake now. No, we always make choices that reinforce our security. That's who we are. We're not evolved enough to do anything else. Your first thought in doing this work, is it for yourself or somebody else? That's why our assemblies fell apart, because everybody at that assembly was there because they wanted to be personally safe from the COVID regulations. They didn't care necessarily about anybody else. And the test of that was when we said, look, we've got to go beyond our own situation and start issuing banishment orders and making arrests and taking back the community. Then they tend to drop away. If they can't get it something for themselves, they drop away. That's the impulse of virtually everyone on the planet. Some of us are able to evolve, and I'm not necessarily saying I have, because we always have to keep changing. But I've evolved further than I was back then. And when you forget about yourself, and you live not to live longer, but to die, when you live to die, when you're living for that moment of death that consummates everything you were struggling for, when you forget about yourself and live for others and live for every moment for this higher struggle, you get an inner freedom there that I can't describe. You've got to go through it yourself. And one of our friends in the Republic Alliance shared this with me the other day. She said, I found this inner freedom because I know I can die at any moment, and they're after me now, but that's okay. They can't touch me. I found that inner joy and freedom of selfless action for this higher purpose. And I'm telling you, folks, unless we harness that selfless action in each of us, we can forget about it. Don't bother tuning in again. Just forget about it. Just lie back and let it happen, because it's the only thing that's going to break the hold, first within our hearts and minds and then in the outer world. In other words, this show, like I've said time and again, is for only a few of you, really. And it's called different things. People who are set aside, they call them the elect in the Bible. It's interesting. Unlike what the church tells you, Jesus didn't come to save humanity. If you read the Bible and all the Gnostic sayings and all the traditions coming out of the early Jesus movement, he was always saying the same thing. Not that he was God. That's in the Gospel of John that the church created. No, he says, I'm just a guy with a message, the kingdom of heaven. He was always going on about this kingdom of heaven, which he said is within you. And it's interesting, the Greek translation, he said, it's within you and it's around you. It's already present. You just can't see it. It's a coexisting reality that you can enter into if you die and get reborn. That was really the spiritual meaning of resurrection. It was something for each of us. It wasn't a savior coming to save all of us. It was something we all go through, that spiritual death and rebirth, when we are chosen to go through that. But notice he wasn't speaking to everybody. You know, when he did his Sermon on the Mount, the words say, he turned to his disciples and said, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. And went on like that. He was speaking to them, not the crowd out there that had come for the free loaves and fishes. He addressed the ones set apart to do this work. And that's who I'm trying to address right now. Those of you who know you're set apart, and here's a sign. The early Puritans who, like I said earlier, set up the basis of the American Republic by saying, no pope, no king, the people under God alone in their own assemblies, their own congregations. That was the basis, the model of the U.S. Republic. Well, but the Puritans said that when you are called, you don't know it right away. All you know is that you feel like you're a stranger on the earth, and nothing ever works for you. You can't fit in anywhere. No answer makes any sense. All the people who you go to for answers don't have anything. The only thing that you can find in the world is that light within your heart, that conscience right from the heart and mind of God. And at that point, you realize you're set apart to do this. And through a process of spiritual discernment the Puritan elders had, they would cultivate those people and said, you are called to be the remnant. But the church is not the people. It's that remnant, the true church. And in the Geneva Bible, which is the, you know, the original Bible of the Puritans and the early American Republic, written by William Tyndale, who was burned to the stake for translating it, it was the first Bible taken from the Greek and the Hebrew into English. And in that, the very revolutionary message that there's only a few that are set apart to do this. And the reason I'm going on about that is that, you know, both of you who are listening who understand what I'm saying, this is our time. On three levels, on a personal level, on a spiritual level, and a political level, we're to reclaim ourselves and reclaim the world, not because we're going to save the world. No. As a matter of fact, all prophecy from many different traditions, including the indigenous ones, say this world's ending. There's going to be a big separation. Most people are going to die. Most people are going to be wiped out because they're so attached. Oh, that's interesting. The thunder just shook here. Thank you. A little bit of background there. This world is under judgment, and most people who are attached to this world, and by that I don't mean the natural world, I mean the human world, this corporatized machine that's gradually eating all of us up, it's going down. And when it falls, anybody with even a toehold in it is going to go down too. There has to be that inner separation before there can be the outer one. The inner separation cuts us off from our old past, from everything we thought. People say that, you know, to me when you've been through this hell, they say, everything I know now is a lie, and everything I've been taught is a lie. I'm on a path here. I can't see what the new world is. And I said, that's okay. It'll be shown to you. But just stay on that path outside the system. And that's what I urge every one of you who can hear what I'm saying to do. We have to have the inner separation before the outer can happen. And then we'll be set apart and made fit for what we've been talking about. Okay, so end of that sermon. I hope you understand what I'm sharing from my heart there. There's three books I want to highlight in the 10 minutes left to us, because this is going to guide our work in the days and years ahead. Because, by the way, this is not the short-term thing that most of you expect. Oh, good, we're going to have an answer, and then we can go back to our old lives. No, your old lives are over. Don't hold on to them. There's three books that are a guide in that, and I hope you'll read these, because we're going to base some of the educationals on our Republic Alliance on these three books. The first is Memoirs of a Revolutionary, which looks at, I wrote this last year, to look at the previous 50 years of politics and economics in the world. I kind of weave my life story slightly through it, but mostly it's about understanding the present tyranny. Where did the corporatocracy come from? What are its spiritual, political, economic roots? Very important guide, because it basically shows that everything you're seeing now is an outgrowth of that. It's absorbing like a centripetal force, sucking everything in to itself. Church, state, people, everything is going into this void called the corporatocracy. We see that in Rome and London, like I said earlier. It's all being channeled out of Beijing, which is the spearhead of this corporatocracy, because their system of their Mandarin Confucian system is pre-adapted to be the corporatocracy because of their emperor worship system. Kind of like Rome, but the Vatican is obsolete and collapsing, and things are... It's funny. Sometimes I think that in the same way the Christian church got absorbed into the Roman Empire and it created this new synthesis called the Church of Rome, which is neither the Christianity nor the Roman Empire, but something new. Same thing's happening on the world. The Vatican is getting absorbed with China into a new creation called the corporatocracy, and they both run through emperor worship, that whole notion of pope or emperor. But it's really designed to create this new thing in the world, this global corporatocracy that is our enemy. And only through our own sovereign common law republics can we create an alternative for people. Those are the two poles in the world today, folks. So these three books are very important for learning about that. First of all, Memoirs of a Revolutionary. You can get all these on Amazon, but you can also get them from me. Just write angelfire101 at protonmail.com. First is Memoirs of a Revolutionary. Second is Establishing Liberty, the Case for Kanata. It's the whole argument about why we set up the Republic, why Rome and London were the sources of the genocide and the tyranny in Canada, just like they are in many countries in the world, and what we can do about it, how we go about creating the Republic with our own assemblies and courts, the spirit and the vision driving us, because there's no point talking about the mechanics of what we do and the protests and everything unless we have the vision and the purpose first. And the third book was something written at request. This was a joint effort called Here We Stand. Our show is named after it. Summoning God's People in a Time of Judgment. It's a spiritual break from what we call Christendom. It's for everybody who has that love of Christ and vision in their heart but can't be connected to these corporate genocidal churches anymore, starting with the false Church of Rome, which isn't a church. It's never been a Christian church. It's a cult of emperor worship. That's why the Pope calls himself Vicari Christi, which means the replacement or the one who replaces Christ. Or Pontifex Maximus, the Great Bridge, that's the title of the Roman Emperor. That's the Church of Rome. It's simply an extension of that empire. This book, Here We Stand, is for all those who want a break from false Christendom. So Here We Stand, Establishing Liberty, the Case for Kanata, Memoirs of a Revolutionary. That is a good reading list for you to start. And the reason I'm saying all that is because we need to form a core leadership now. And this is really something we've discovered the hard way by trying to form common law republic assemblies and having them blown apart, because not simply because of infiltrators, which happened, especially in the west coast of Kanata. The Chinese are taking over that whole area. And we're going to talk about that next week, especially in relation to Vancouver and other things happening there. But for now, know that the whole experience of setting up assemblies was destroyed not even primarily by infiltrators, but by the people themselves, because there's vastly different levels of understanding, awareness, commitment, and the more conscious people are brought down to the level of the lowest and who have to be taught all this stuff, and they get frustrated. Like Sun Tzu says, in a war, if you go down to the level of the least prepared, it's suicide. It's not a democracy. It is a system whereby the vanguard is led by the veterans, the most conscious, the most organized and clear, and the most committed, willing to fight to the death every day. Those are the ones who are the leadership, and those are the ones we reach and organize. That's why, in response to our takedown in the assemblies in Kanata, we have formed cell groups, leadership cells of three people, who then go out and organize other cells of three. And eventually, when they work together and have enough experience, then they form assemblies. It's on a more solid foundation. Now, these are the cells, to take it back to the original point about how we bring down the Vatican. The thing going on at the UN now it's happening at a certain level. But at every level, we have an obligation to go to our town councils, like has started in Kanata already, and say, nullify the tax exemptions of this genocidal church, the Catholic Church. We are not going to subsidize them anymore. We're not allowed to under international law. There's a notice about that, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates. You'll see all those documents over the last four or five postings. Take that motion. Go to your city council or town council and demand that they pass that bylaw. Otherwise, they'll be thrown out of office in the next election. That's what politicians understand. That's one tool. The other one is church occupations and land reclamations, which Indigenous people are doing, throwing the Catholic Church and the United Church, the Anglican Church, off their lands and reclaiming them, take over the buildings, open them up as community centers. We've got a whole manual of how to do that. Again, write to Republic National Council at protonmail.com. But we have to have that leadership core organized in these cell groups to lead that. And that's why I say, first of all, don't worry about launching assemblies right away. Form the cell groups. Get educated. Get clear. Because it's people who are the most clear who are the most committed. You can have commitment, but unless it's informed and organized, it's steam without a piston. We have to organize that piston now and mobilize the steam at the same time. And that's what we're doing. That's the whole purpose and the theme of this show. And with a few minutes left, I just want to announce, too, that there'll be more announcements of what's going on in New York and around the world in response to the new campaign. This wasn't just today. It's going to be an ongoing campaign, taking the kinds of actions I've talked about, revoking the oath of allegiance to the crown. Every Commonwealth country needs to start doing that in Australia, New Zealand, England, Canada, all of these Commonwealth countries. Revoke the oath of allegiance to this dummy, the clown on the throne, as I call him, Charlie. Revoke it and take the oath of allegiance to the republic where you are, to the people, to a constitution. That's what democracy means, not oath of allegiance to one man or one woman. So these are all tools we can use, but it's got to be organized. And like I say, do your reading and homework. Murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates and all the other links there. Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.org. And by the way, Kanata means where the people sit as one around the council fire. Equality and oneness. That's from the Haudenosaunee Iroquois word and the practice. And the Tuawampum flag of equality between the European settlers and the indigenous, that's right in our flag. That's the philosophy and spirit of all that we do. And on that final note, to be involved, Republic National Council at protonmail.com. Look at all those flyers and PDFs on those postings at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. Read through it. Run them off. Use them. But write to us at that email in guidance about how to use it. If children die tomorrow, it's because of what we don't do today. If we are living under a corporate tyranny 50 years from now, it's because of what we didn't do today. Always remember this. Take it to heart and think of those children on the ground. Now, I'm going to end with a part of that teaching is a short little 5-minute tutorial on civil disobedience with Henry David Thoreau. We're going to end with that lesson, and we'll be back again live next week, same time, same place. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Stay strong, stay clear. Most importantly, take action. Bye for now.
In March 1845, the United States acquired a new president, James K. Polk, a forceful, aggressive political outsider, intent on strengthening his country and asserting its preeminence in front of other world powers, especially Mexico and Great Britain. Within a year of his inauguration, he had declared full-scale war on Mexico because of squabbles over the Texan border, and was soon rattling his saber at Britain over the ownership of Oregon. To complete the picture, Polk was a vigorous defender of slavery, who dismissed the arguments of abolitionists as naive and sentimental. Polk was a popular president, admired by many for his gung-ho manner, but a sizable minority of the citizenry disliked him intensely. One especially committed opponent was a writer from Massachusetts called Henry David Thoreau. Thoreau is now a canonical American literary figure, studied in every high school for his lyrical masterpiece, Walden. But there is another, more political side to Thoreau, now usually airbrushed out of his story, which came to the fore in relation to the president. Thoreau quickly realized that he was opposed to everything Polk stood for. He hated what became the Mexican-American War, instinctively siding with the losing Mexican side. He was wary of Polk's squabbles with Britain and was appalled by the administration's policy of hunting down and returning runaway slaves to their masters in the South. Thoreau's anger against his president found its impassioned expression in an essay he published in 1849, now known as Civil Disobedience. At the heart of the essay is the question of what an honest citizen should do about a president he or she wholeheartedly opposes. The prevailing view was that because Polk had won a majority, those who were against him should now fall silent. It should, it was often said, be the duty of a good citizen to fold away their objections and just respect the will of the majority. But this was precisely the point Thoreau wished to probe and upturn. He suggested that true patriots were not those who blindly followed their administration. They were those who followed their own consciences, and in particular, the principles of reason. Thoreau wished to redistribute prestige away from blinkered obedience towards independent thought. What marked out a noble citizen of the Republic, a real American, was not, in Thoreau's view, that they respectfully shut up, but that they thought for themselves every day of an administration's life. On the basis of just this kind of independent thinking, Thoreau signaled a radical opposition to Polk's term. He denounced the Mexican-American War, the repatriation of slaves, and the outlook of the government more generally. And so as to underline his opposition, Thoreau held back payment of his taxes. In July 1846, he walked into Concord, Massachusetts to get his shoes repaired and was promptly arrested and thrown into the town's jail. Thoreau saw nothing undignified about spending some time behind bars. As he wrote, "Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is a prison." All machines have their friction, Thoreau admitted, but when injustice is too great, you should let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. Thoreau didn't advocate the non-payment of taxes as a rule, and in fact, a well-meaning aunt soon paid his bill. The non-payment was just one example of the many non-violent ways that a democratically elected government could and should be resisted whenever its actions veer into aggression or unreason. An election may settle who the president might be, but it doesn't determine that everything the president does is right or that one should simply do nothing until the next election. Above all, Thoreau hated political passivity. Sarcastically, he wrote, "There are thousands who are, in opinion, opposed to slavery and to the war, who yet, in effect, do nothing to put an end to them, who, esteeming themselves children of Washington and Franklin, sit down with their hands in their pockets and say that they know not what to do and do nothing." This would not be Thoreau's way. How does it become a man to behave towards this American government today? I answer that he cannot without disgrace be associated with it. Thoreau argued that the citizen must never just resign his conscience to the legislation and put himself at the service of some unscrupulous man in power. Thoreau mocked that most legislators, politicians, lawyers, ministers, and office holders are as likely to serve the devil without intending it as God. Thoreau would not be such a servant. This most American of writers knew exactly whom it was right for him to serve, his own mind and conscience.